Hello, hello. Welcome to Pilled, where you can join the masses of crypto pilled degens. And if you're not one of them, well, just you wait. I'm your host, Anisha Sankarneni, and this is Pilled.
Hi, Ray. Thank you so much for coming on to Pilled today. How are you doing?
Doing good. Yeah, good to be on.
So I just wanted to get started by maybe having you introduce yourself and giving the audience a little bit of background on where you work, who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. So currently I'm one of the co-founders and the CTO of Gauntlet. And Gauntlet is a financial modeling platform for crypto. And prior to starting Gauntlet, I started my career as a quant trader working in the high frequency trading industry. So yeah, I spent a number of years basically being a high frequency market maker in traditional financial markets. So covering a bunch of different asset classes, equities, futures, a foreign exchange. And yeah, I had a bunch of like years as a kind of operator in the markets and took that time to learn a lot about kind of exchange market structure, microstructure in the excruciating amount of detail. And then in between that and starting Gauntlet, I worked at Uber for a few years as a software engineer. I was part of the marketplace optimization team at Uber, which was essentially a team that was responsible for developing surge pricing algorithms, dispatch policies, and things like that for their network. And interestingly enough, one of the main projects I worked on as part of that team, and this was a team that went from 25 people to about 400 people in the span of 2 years, was essentially building an agent-based simulation for Uber's networks. So it was like modeling riders and drivers behave in the system, essentially. And the goal of the simulation was to essentially be the internal experimentation platform for all these pricing algorithms and things like that that the team was developing. And so the idea would be that you run these algorithms through simulation, make sure things look good before you figure out your live rollout strategy or A/B tests or whatever, whatnot. And
very
so,
cool.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of spent most of my career thinking about markets and market design. And got into crypto, not too dissimilar, probably not the most unique answer, but saw crypto as an area where just a lot of interesting kind of work was happening, kind of intersection of a lot of different disciplines, but then also really interested in the kind of market design or incentive mechanism design component of crypto. I think it's really this decentralized system of incentives that enables these crypto systems to be decentralized in the first place. And ultimately, I see crypto as a kind of interesting area for kind of unlocking better global collaboration and being able to build organizations that are somewhat orthogonal to traditional corporations, for example.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds like you've had an extensive number of years just digging into like markets and algorithms and thinking about behavior. Appreciate you giving us that background. I feel like you've already answered this question, but I always have to ask my guests how they initially became crypto-filled. And I know it sounds like you were pursuing an interesting area, which was like aligned with your interests and just dug even deeper into it once you started. But was there a specific moment or time that initially crypto-pilled you, or if you had any moment like that at all?
I think it's hard to, I guess for me, it's hard to boil down to like a single moment. I think I've always been following crypto kind of in the background. You know, kind of was aware of Bitcoin from like the very early days, contemplated setting up a mining rig for Bitcoin. And you know, I want to say it was like 2011, something around there.
Oh, wow.
Didn't end up doing it, unfortunately. But then just thought it was very interesting, like almost like academic experiment at the time. And of course, fast forward a number of years to kind of 2017. Yep. Started paying a lot more attention to it. And in particular, was really interested in Ethereum and the new set of capabilities that a protocol like that could unlock. And started thinking about what it actually takes to build and kind of essentially build these systems in a kind of a responsible way and kind of understanding how to design the mechanisms, how to parameterize the mechanisms that will ultimately make these things successful. And a similar idea ended up kind of leading to the very beginnings of Gauntlet, essentially.
Yeah, wow. I feel like it was a very stepwise path, but it makes a lot of sense why you're doing what you're doing now. I know we wanted to talk a little bit about risk management, which is something you think about a lot in your role at Gauntlet in general. And probably you specifically have a great deal of perspective on, given all the things you've done in the past. So just at a high level, if we were to start breaking down risk management in general in crypto, how do we start doing that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So yeah, Gauntlet has been thinking about risk management as it pertains to DeFi and crypto for quite some time.
I think maybe even backing up, maybe giving anyone who isn't familiar with Gauntlet a very high level overview of what Gauntlet does, maybe helpful moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Gauntlet is a financial modeling platform for crypto. And we essentially want to enable bringing off-chain intelligence on-chain for making DeFi protocols more safer and more efficient. So for risk management in particular, we work with a lot of the kind of leading lending protocols in the space right now, and essentially aiming to be the risk desk for DeFi. And in addition, we're actually also developing a protocol named Era, which is a Ethereum-based protocol, which we hope will become the decentralized platform for essentially advancing the on-chain economy.
Wow, that's a lot to digest there, but makes even more sense why being the risk desk of crypto or DeFi, you can speak to us about risk management. So I guess we can jump back to breaking that down.
Yeah, for sure. At a high level, we think of risk management for DeFi as essentially being this optimization problem of trying to balance capital efficiency with risk, right? On one hand, on the capital efficiency side, you want to enable users of these protocols to deploy capital efficiency, enable some amount of leverage in the system, not have to pay too much in the event of liquidations, and essentially be able to operate in these systems at like a low cost, right? But on the flip side, if systemically or as a protocol, you enable users in the aggregate to take on too much risk or take on too much, this can certainly cause issues for the protocol if in the case where market prices are decreasing quickly over a short period of time in some type of market crash scenario. And in particular, if there is not enough liquidity in the system to support the liquidations that need to happen, the kind of protocol can be essentially stuck with a lot of kind of bad loans or bad debt. And so that's something that we try to work with these communities to try to avoid. And I guess like the primary mechanism for risk management in DeFi right now is through like careful setting of an optimization of chain parameters. And so in the case of lending protocols, this would be things like collateral factor or liquidation incentives. So essentially, the main levers controlling how much leverage you enable in the system and the costs to users when there are liquidations.
Absolutely. This might be a kind of like naive question for anyone in the audience that may not have as deep of an understanding in DeFi or might even just understand TradFi more. And given that you like worked in that industry previously, what do you think are like the biggest parallels or even differences when considering risk management in TradFi versus DeFi?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think at a high level, I think a lot of the principles are pretty analogous between kind of DeFi and TradFi. But of course, the market structure and the kind of the nature of the protocols tends to be pretty different. I graduated college in 2009. And so that was coming out of the depths of the great financial crisis in 2008, which in many ways was like pretty analogous to the situation that we've seen unfold in crypto in the last few months, where you have a number of centralized financial firms being overlevered or having some hidden amount of leverage that was forced to unwind or kind of liquidate within a short period of time, and saw the second order's effects of that kind of ripple through the system. And during my years as a high frequency trader, you can certainly just understand the importance of a liquidity in markets. And you see a lot of these scenarios of where having a lack of liquidity can lead to, in some sense, like market failures for short periods of time. And I think DeFi and crypto have enabled a whole fundamentally different set of capabilities. But at the same time, there are still learnings from traditional finance and traditional finance market structure that, you know, can still be.
Absolutely. That makes a ton of sense. I think it sounds like in order to just make sure that there's enough liquidity, are there certain parameters that you guys try to put into effect at Gauntlet specifically to make sure there's not over leverage or insufficient liquidity? Are there just general frameworks by which you think about it?
Yeah, for sure. I guess at a high level, the primary kind of methodology, if you will, that we use to assess risk in these crypto systems is through agent-based simulation. So yeah, very similar type of framework, but kind of just applied to different set of markets with different set of participants, a different market structure. And the primary advantage of agent-based simulations is that it allows you to break down the modeling of a very complex system with many different independent agents or kind of users or participants into kind of more primitive models are modular, composable, and kind of easy to understand. And we have Gauntlet have built out the infrastructure for running these simulations. And we enable, essentially, we can run these simulations directly on smart contract logic of these protocols. So we don't have to replicate the business specific logic. And we can do this in a highly parallelized fashion to be able to run thousands of different scenarios every day.
And doing all of these like simulations, or like even just from having been around for so long, do you see the same kind of like patterns arise when there are like failures in the system? Either there's like over leverage or there isn't enough liquidity. Are there oftentimes like the same sort of ingredients for disaster that result in those types of events?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some kind of rough patterns that we've seen play out a few times. And I think this kind of is very analogous to typical economic cycles in some sense, where there's some period of or some number of years of a kind of bull market followed by some type of like recession or kind of market correction. And being on the risk side of things, it is often difficult to get people to kind of concerned or having risk be top of mind in a bull market, which is crypto has been a bull market for a couple of years, starting with DeFi summer in 2020 up until kind of earlier this year. It's hard to get people to care about these extreme market scenarios that seem pretty hypothetical at the time, but when they start playing out, it can be hard to get people to reason about this nonlinear kind of behavior in markets. And so one example here is we went against listing UST, which is the kind of stable coin from Luna blockchain as collateral in many of these lending protocols. And it's something that was met with some resistance over time. But of course, after the events that happened in May, I think people have a little bit better understanding of where we might be coming from previously.
And when you guys like communicate that, or in the way that you did communicate it, how did you guys caution people to not use UST as collateral, even whether or not they chose to heed that advice?
Yeah, I think the decision to list a particular collateral asset is always a little bit of a tricky one. A part of it is because of the kind of way that some of these lending protocols are designed, in the sense that they're trying to have more capital efficiency by pooling together essentially all the total value locked or all the assets in a single pool. And this can lead to a situation where essentially enabling kind of one kind of risky asset in the pool can put all the collateral at risk. And so this is why these listings historically have needed to be taken very seriously. And so the protocols are definitely adding new features and kind of more fine-grained risk controls that kind of mitigate the potential downside risk of asset listings going forward. But over the last couple of years, this is something that we've had to treat very carefully. And so, yeah, there's a couple of different reasons why, at least a couple of different reasons why, listing an asset might be a bad idea. And for one, this can be more on the kind of market risk side of things, where the underlying liquidity for this particular token is just not sufficient to support the extent that it will be used in these protocols. And so this kind of means that the market price, it might be pretty easy to manipulate, or it doesn't cost very much to kind of move the market price for that particular asset. And in the case of UST, there are some kind of underlying kind of structural reasons why that asset might not be as stable or as robust as people think. Yeah, definitely something that needs to be thought about in a bit of a case-by-case situation, rather than trying to apply a set of simple heuristics across the board.
Absolutely. And I think something you mentioned earlier about people not always being super excited to think about risk a lot in peak bull market, but it's still something important to never allow yourself to like fully forget about that. Risk is always going to be there. How do you like, just if you were to be like, hey, like you do need to think about risk even during a bull market, what would be like the most effective way to keep that in mind?
Yeah, I think it's hard to come up with a generalized rule necessarily, but at least as it comes to kind of risk management, this is why we try to, continually educate the communities from our perspective. When we put out a lot of technical content, including research, as well as kind of market case studies. And we always try to contextualize parameter recommendations that we make or risk recommendations that we make for broader understanding.
Amazing. So I think we touched a little bit at a high level about risk management, especially within the context of DeFi and at Gauntlet. What are the things that you consider? But if we were to think a little bit more about the actual risk factors in DeFi specifically as pertaining to either the market or like smart contract risk factors, maybe we can break each of those down a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Gauntlet primarily focuses on understanding market risk in the context of the protocols that we work with. And yeah, notably, this excludes a set of pretty significant risk factors that we don't explicitly cover, but this might include smart contract risks, and there might be an underlying bug in the Solidity contracts that enables some type of exploit. And you know, we've seen different patterns of this, including re-entrancy style attacks. Kind of over the years, there are, I think this is like the realm of smart contract auditors and kind of security experts that focus on, yeah, essentially auditing and trying to mitigate some of these risks in contracts. Another risk that we currently don't explicitly cover is this notion of kind of bridge risk. And this is similar that bridging between bridge protocols between different blockchains are still fairly nascent. And there are fairly complex types of risks, including a smart contract risk that needs to be taken into account. And as we've seen times of the past couple of years, these kind of bridges are definitely, in some sense, like a honeypot for hackers with the kind of asset concentration in one area. So in terms of market risks, I think we've talked a little bit about this before, but just I think one thing that's really important is understanding kind of liquidity profile for all the collateral assets and assets more broadly that are enabled in these protocols. Just making sure participants, namely liquidators, can essentially trade out of these assets without incurring too much market slippage or market impact. And this is something that's essential to making sure that liquidations happen in these protocols in a efficient manner, essentially. And we've seen some recent examples, such as the kind of Mango Markets attack on the Solana blockchain. Essentially having illiquid collateral assets has led to price or oracle manipulation that has been very costly and difficult for the protocol to recover from. And then in addition to liquidity concerns, it's also important to consider kind of market structure features such as like flash loans or recursive borrows that are a little bit unique to DeFi, but can make some of these attack vectors more viable than they may seem on the surface.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sounds like there are a lot of different risks to consider. And it's important to think about each of those because they do occur in different ways, and not having an audit done correctly or with the bridges, you have to be looking out for different things. I wanted to talk, you mentioned the Mango market hacker, but I also wanted to talk about some other recent events with all the stuff that's been happening first with FTX and then the domino effect from there. So maybe we can delve a little bit into those recent events and just chat a little bit about whether risk management was done correctly or poorly, a little bit about centralized versus decentralized exchanges and DeFi in general, and kind of just talk through some of the stuff that's happened.
Yeah, for sure. So I think this FTX scenario has certainly escalated a lot faster than many people imagined.
At a high level, maybe we can give people a quick 10-second summary about what happened with FTX.
Yeah, FTX was one of the largest centralized crypto exchanges in the space. I think if there's something ranked either third or fourth by average daily volume, and essentially went from strength to essentially declaring bankruptcy within a matter of days. And right now, people are still trying to piece together exactly what happened that led to the situation, but it seems at least a few things were involved. I think one feature is definitely hidden leverage in the system, and using hidden leverage using collateral assets that were not liquid. In particular, the FTT token, which is the kind of DeFi own token, was used as a collateral asset, which is the equivalent of a traditional company using their own stock as collateral on their books. A second issue that might be at play is essentially a commingling of funds between the exchange as well as Alameda, which was a proprietary trading firm, acted as a market maker to liquidity on that exchange. And in particular, kind of has been called into question whether customer funds were used in this process. And it seems like things have escalated quite quickly. And now essentially there's more or less kind of alleged fraud as well on top of that. So kind of what from my understanding of my default assumption coming into the scenario was that, okay, this is like a failure of risk management that probably dated back to at least early May when Three Arrows Capital blew up. And maybe customer funds were used to cover that up. But it seems things go a lot deeper.
Definitely has gone 0 to 100 in a bad way really quickly. I think some things that I just had to refresh my memory on and make sure I had clear when I was following all of this was like the difference between liquid and illiquid and solvent and insolvent. Could you quickly give us definitions for each of those before dive into talking about this more?
Yeah, so I guess there's a lot of ways of looking or of defining liquidity. And so I guess one way to look at it is to look at it from the perspective of kind of market slippage or market impact. And this is basically for a given asset, how quickly can I trade out of this position? And how much market slippage is the notion of how much does it cost for me to trade out this position if I needed to right now? And market impact essentially is the notion of how much will I impact the future price of this particular asset as a result of trading out of my position. And yeah, I think on one end of the spectrum, you have, say, US equities that are very liquid, have very deep markets. There's a lot of market makers that are constantly quoting both bid and offer. And then on the illiquid side of the spectrum, these are kind of assets that have essentially no immediate venue or exchange that they're traded on.
Yes. And then when it comes to these exchanges, when they say they're either solvent or insolvent, what does that mean? And how does that kind of tie in with like liquidity or their ability to provide liquidity?
Yeah. The notion of being solvent is essentially having enough collateral assets or assets to back up any liabilities that the exchange might have. And liquidity is particularly important here in that if there is some type of capital call where you need to come up with the cash to cover your liabilities, if your collateral is denoted in kind of liquid assets, then this process is very easy. You can just do this on some exchange somewhere versus if your collateral is illiquid assets, then you might move the market a lot against you in the process of trying to recover value from those assets, or there might just not be a market or anyone to take the other side at all.
Right. And with FTX, we saw all of this play out in a matter of less than a week, I think, where they had so much in supposed assets and then very quickly had to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And one of the biggest things that I feel like has been brought up is that they were a centralized exchange and we likely wouldn't see things play out in the same fashion if it was in DeFi. So maybe we can delve into a little bit about the differences of that and why them being a centralized exchange made certain things more opaque until things played out the way that they did.
Yeah, I think the primary structural advantage of DeFi here is essentially like the radical on-chain transparency of the system, right? So it's just very difficult to have hidden positions or hidden liabilities or hidden leverage in the system where essentially everything, all the data, underlying data is publicly available. And so this means that kind of the community or really can effectively audit the protocol and understand whether there are sufficient reserves, whether liabilities are backed by collateral and things of this nature. But I think the other kind of thing that helps in this scenario is that currently DeFi protocols, being still in relative infancy relative to centralized finance, are relatively capital inefficient and don't offer quite the same levels of leverage versus centralized financial systems. And that kind of also contributes to a generally higher margin of safety here as well.
Absolutely. And is there a particular reason, or is it just because things are still very nascent, that in DeFi there is relatively less capital efficiency in the ways that you just described with the leverage or otherwise?
Yeah, I think the ecosystem is still pretty young. I think fundamentally, things are still a little bit limited by the kind of underlying kind of throughput of the blockchains. And so if you take Ethereum as an example, Ethereum can only process on the order of 15 transactions per second globally. And that kind of just limits the number of, say, liquidations or Oracle price updates that can happen within a short period of time. And so because of that inherent throughput limit, these protocols are forced to be a little bit more conservative when it comes to kind of risk parameters. And so, of course, there are plenty of scalability improvements at many different layers of the stack coming online that have come online over the past few years. And so, yeah, we should expect the efficiency of these systems to improve both from like an underlying structural perspective, but then also in terms of like innovation at the protocol layer as well. Over time, we would expect to see futures or perpetual swaps or options or other derivatives be available natively on chain as well.
Absolutely. I think that'll be really exciting to watch that unfold in the next few years or so. I feel like I've spoken to a lot of people who have been in crypto far longer than I have and who've just suggested that the events of the last few weeks with FTX and everything that came after have been some of just the craziest, most unforeseen scenarios that that they've seen in the time that they've been working in this industry. I was curious to know if you felt that way as well, or if there were any particular aspects of everything that's been happening that have really just, I don't want to say got to you, but just really threw you off or made you even like think about something in particular?
Yeah, I'd say like FTX definitely is, of course, definitely a huge event in the industry. I guess in my mind, I think most, I guess I wouldn't necessarily rank it in a different category versus a lot of the other kind of failures that we've seen over the years. I think Terra and Luna probably ranks just as highly for me in that we saw the consequences of just having mechanisms that were just not designed in a robust fashion unraveling. I think FTX was probably just the most jarring for me because of like the prior public image that FTX had versus things as it's unraveled. I see FTX as less of a kind of structural failure and a little bit more analogous to, I guess in some sense, more like a Enron or Lehman type of scenario that you see in just financial markets every X number of years. And so I see this as a broader markets thing as opposed to it being something that is like kind of like crypto specific failure in some sense.
For sure. Do you think that with the aftermath of the events, not just FTX, but even Terra Luna earlier this year, that people have a different risk appetite or they're thinking about risk management, hopefully a little bit more, since I feel like so many organizations, funds, companies, individuals were impacted directly or indirectly. But as you also mentioned before, these kinds of things do happen every few years. And whether or not they're entirely predictable, they're not wholly unpredictable if you look into it a little bit more. Do you think people are going to be taking risk management a little bit more seriously?
I think risk management and treasury management is definitely very top of mind for folks in the space as well. I guess even more at the macro level, like we're definitely in a risk-off environment right now, crypto especially, but also markets and tech more broadly as well. I think a lot of this is hard to totally decouple from just the overall higher interest rate environment that we're in right now. And when the kind of risk-free rate is 4% approaching 5%, the bar for return on risky investments is just that much higher. And yeah, and then within crypto, hopefully this kind of leaves a lasting impression on the industry to essentially grow responsibly as things progress from here. And I think this is also where the services that Gauntlet offers, both on the risk management side and then as well as what we're trying to build with Era, should be a good opportunity there as well for DAOs and other customers to essentially be more disciplined about risk management, managing runway, managing treasury over time.
Absolutely. I think so too. I do want to wrap things up, but I also want to ask one more question about Gauntlet's protocol that you guys have under development. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how you think that ties in directly and indirectly to risk management?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, Era is going to be the decentralized platform for advancing the on-chain economy. And so the idea behind Era is to make capital allocations on-chain in a more efficient manner. And Era will support many use cases down the road. One initial use case that we are focused on is very much adjacent to risk management and DeFi. And one of the main problems right now is if you look at some of the largest lending protocols in the space, they do set aside some amount of reserve or treasury for catastrophic risk scenarios. But if you look at the kind of breakdown of those reserve assets, they're essentially mostly denominated in the protocol's native governance token. And as we've seen time and time again, that's not a particularly good strategy. Essentially, the value of your reserve is likely to be worth the least when you need it the most. A natural strategy there is to essentially try to diversify, right? And so you can imagine you might want to purchase some amount of Ethereum token. You should probably allocate some portion to stable coins. And you might even want to have some portion in out of the money put options on Ethereum, for example, to give downside protection, when it's needed. And Era essentially offers a solution, both making the allocation decisions for which assets to include in this portfolio, as well as the kind of trading and rebalancing into those assets in a native on-chain decentralized fashion. And the idea is that for a given Era vault, stakeholders need to align in the beginning in terms of like figuring out the exact objective function for the fund held in the vault, but then all the subsequent allocation and rebalancing decisions are handled in a governance-free fashion. And we see this as a great way to radically reduce the kind of cost of on-chain coordination.
That sounds really interesting, and I'm excited to see that put into effect. Thank you so much for coming on. I have one last non-risk management question for you, and I always try to end with if you could pill us on something that was not crypto related at all or put us onto something, what would it be?
So I would put this kind of in the life hack category. So I'm a big fan of sous vide. And so this is basically essentially a way of like cooking food, usually meat, in basically a very precise temperature controlled fashion. And yeah, because it's basically a very easy way to make kind of restaurant worthy food at home, essentially.
It's like your go-to. I've never done that before. If I were to, do I need specific things for it?
So I guess essentially sous vide machine is more or less like a heating element with a thermostat built in. So the idea is that you cook food in like a water bath. And I think if you get into it, you typically use like a vacuum sealer type thing, but you can start off using cloth bags or whatnot. But the idea is that like the doneness of meat is essentially kind of determined by like the maximum internal temperature that that food reaches. And the amount of time that the food is at that temperature is actually not super important yet.
Do you have a favorite meat or dish to use that machine with?
It's hard to go wrong with steaks. By doing this, you can basically have a steak that is kind of perfectly medium rare. Actually, surprisingly, chicken breast is another good one because obviously people don't like medium rare chicken, but people also don't like overcooked chicken.
Where did you get your machine from?
I think I just found it on Amazon originally. I think I have the Innova one, but yeah, that's particularly expensive. So you can get one from any number of places for probably like $100.
I feel like I should get this for my dad. I feel like this is a good dad who likes to experiment with cooking gadget, toy.
Yeah, for sure. It's basically you can take food that's like straight from the freezer and drop it in and you have something that's like perfectly cooked. This is definitely something I've been pushing on my family for a number of years now. So that everyone in my family and extended family has one at this point.
Oh my God. I love it. And then I can benefit from it if he just cooks for me when I go home. So this sounds great. Thank you so much for that. And thanks again for coming on. This was a great conversation.
Cool. Thank you.